So today, our plan, we're going to finish out talking about system ID in the kind of conceptual level. Talk much more about that on Tuesday. Then we'll discuss what's going to be on your exam a week from today, right? And then work through with the remaining time example problems until we're out of time, basically. I did post yesterday morning sometime the solutions to that last homework. So you can take a look at those. And then we'll take some example problems today. And likely we'll post a supplemental set of problems with solutions for you guys to take a look at and have some extra solutions to look at when you're prepping for the exam. We'll talk more about exam in just a minute. Before we get to that, I wanted to finish off talking about system identification. So the system identification techniques we talked about on Tuesday were all time domain based, right? We had a time versus amplitude plot, and we were looking at one, counting zero crossings to get period of the system, which would give us then information about natural frequency, of course. And then we looked at the decay of that information, and we learned about log deck. Which again, both of those methods, particularly log deck, are used every day, basically. And those are both, in both of those cases, we're looking at the free vibration of the system to get that. Right, so in our crane example, we walked up, grabbed the crane hook, displaced it, and let it go. Right. It's often done, actually, depending on the system, there's special hammers that you actually hit the thing with that you're trying to measure the vibration on, an impact hammer. So generally, you're going to excite the system in some way, and then you want to record the free vibration response to use the techniques we just talked about. Okay. We've talked about another, another entire category of system response. And we talked about different varieties of force responses. So I'm forcing the system at a known frequency. I have a known input to the system over time. Okay. So I had plots, and we developed plots that look something like this, where we might have input frequency on the horizontal axis, and then some kind of magnitude, and maybe normalized in some way on the vertical axis, right? What kind of response plot is this a part of? There's often another component of it. What's that called? You talked about time responses. What's the other type?
Frequency
response, right? So we're looking at how the system responds as a function of the input frequency. It's frequency response. That actually is a pretty common mistake on this first midterm. Some folks don't get that straight for some reason. We ask for time response, and you plot this frequency response, or you do the opposite. So don't make that mistake. And we saw that, well, we looked at this plot. For example, let's look at maybe the direct force case. So we have a system and we can act on it directly, force it directly, right? So we start at some constant. And at some frequency, we go off to infinity. We don't have any damping. Okay? And I can know that we have some response like this. If I have a force acting on this second order oscillatory system. Right. And I know I should get phase information that looks like this. I'm either exactly in phase or exactly out of phase. I don't have any damping, right? So, my question to you then is, if I know that I get responses that look something like this, and we know about the changes that happen with damping, how can I use this to get information about a system that I might have sitting on the table in front of me? how could I use this knowledge to get me system parameters, right? That's what system ID is all about, right? Given some response to the system, can I tell what the actual parameters? Can I figure out what K and C and M are? Can find natural frequency. Where is the natural frequency going to be at this on this plot? It's going to be where the thing blows up or if there is some damping about where this peak occurs, right? So we can get some pretty good estimate of natural frequency just looking at where that peak is happening. Particularly if it's kind of a sharp peak. We know we have low damping. We know it's going to be pretty close to the natural frequency. Okay? So I can get natural frequency just by kind of figuring out where this line is. Before we continue, though, I have some system. Set it on the table in front of you. How do I actually generate this plot? Vary the frequency of what? The input, right? So what we said is, hey, I have some box here that has some flexible stuff inside it, and I can measure what's happening, right? And basically what we said in this case is I have some kind of force, and that force is some harmonic. Let's just call it a sine, right? So I can fix the amplitude, and then it's omega, the sine of that input, to that flexible system. At omega is the frequency I'm input, I moving the thing back and forth. So I'm forcing it back and forth. Okay? So what I need to do then to generate this is what? Give me a little bit more detail. I need to vary the frequency. What should I do? What's the experimental procedure? Record some displacement. Give me a little bit more detail than that. So I set a frequency to begin with. Okay? So we have omega 1 of my set or whatever. What do I do? Set this frequency. Start exciting the thing. What do I need to do? I need to measure the magnitude of the output. When do I measure that? Can I measure it right away when it starts up? Right, I have to let it get to steady state. Right, all the stuff for the frequency domain we're talking about is steady state oscillation. So I have to give it some time for the transient oscillation, the oscillation from the startup phase of everything starting moving to kind of die out. Right, and if there's any damping at all, it will. In real life, there's always damping. Right, on most systems. So I start this thing out. Let's say I pick some low frequency to start, sweeping over this range. Started oscillating, I wait a little while, and it looks like it's kind of steady state now, so we're on the same amplitude. Right? So I pick off the magnitude of that response. We usually measure that peak to peak. Right? So you get the max part of the sine wave, the negative side, look at those two. That's what this guy is, peak to peak magnitude. Okay. So okay, I have a data point. Now what do I do? I increase my omega a little bit, wait for it to get to steady state, another data point. Yes, sir?
If it's a damp system, how do you know when sensitivity
decays? Does the, what decays out if you have damping? The transient response decays, right? But this force response, I reach a steady state amplitude. So I've picked off another data point, measured the amplitude, perhaps measured the phase. Keep track of that. What's next? Let's repeat that. Market data looks like that. Okay. You're not going to get a nice smooth curve, right? And in fact, why didn't I draw any data up here? Yeah, that's a place where, depending on what system you're actually oscillating, you could be getting into big trouble, right? So, quite often you won't have really good data around this peak, particularly if you have low damping. And again, you know, that data kind of fills in. Around there too. So I can start constructing something like one of these frequency response plots experimentally. And I can do that by doing a pure sine wave at every frequency. You also can do that, and the more advanced way to do that is actually change this frequency as a function of time. So you're sweeping sine wave. So you get it oscillating back and forth. And then as it's oscillating, you're kind of always measuring the amplitude. This guy, this omega here, is a function of time. And generally is increasing over time too. So there are ways to take that sine wave sweep over a system and knock out kind of all of this data in one trial. Kind of. But it's effectively doing the same thing. Looking at the frequency content of the input, this omega, measuring the magnitude and phase of the output. And that's going to let us find, we might see this thing start cranking up, start getting towards the limits of its oscillation, right? You might have data like this. If there's some kind of hard limit in your system that the system's banging against now, I can't oscillate any further, right? But that's a good indication that, hey, there's probably a natural frequency somewhere in there. If I'm oscillating to a fact where I start slamming against the hard stops on the system, okay? Might not have any data there. Yeah. So I have some estimate, probably, from these two guys together of what my natural frequency is. Okay. How do we get to damping? If we have, you know, start with just the theoretical curves. You're given a theoretical frequency response plot. How could you figure out what the damping ratio is? I have to know where the peak is. Okay, so let's draw up another one of these maybe. I had a different system that's maybe like this. Yep, so I want to measure the damp natural frequency, but that also that then still requires me knowing exactly where that peak is, which I'm generally not going to be able to do. Every sensor, just like every model we do, is going to be wrong. Every sensor that you're going to use is going to be wrong too. Right? It's going to be noise, miscalibrated even just a little bit. Right? So how do we get to damping? I think you're going by with a peak shift left. We know that if damping increases. What else happens to the peak? It gets lower. Okay. So the damping changes the height of that peak. Is there anything that we could measure that against that might be constant for all damping ratios? That could give us then information about how that changes versus damping ratio. If we can map out that relationship, we probably can back out what the damping ratio is then, right? If I have a particular condition in my system where it's the same no matter what the damping ratio is, and a different condition that changes based on what the damping ratio is, I can do that comparison for each system and back out, okay, what's the damping ratio maybe? So looking at our plot here, do we have anything like that? So I could look here, but they're all going through minus 90 right here, right? And they asymptotically approach being exactly out of phase or exactly in phase. So that's still going to be hard to do if you're talking about asymptotically approaching something. What's that? Yeah, down here, right? This is always the same, actually. So if in the limit, if the omega goes to zero, right, I have a constant force on the thing. It's not a harmonic input anymore. So I have static deflection there. That static deflection is not dependent upon damping. But the height of that peak is. So I can look then, maybe, at the ratio of the what this peak is to what displacement I have down here at really low frequencies. Okay. Well, let's look at the math behind that. So if this is a direct force system, what's that? I remember it offhand? Is that, right? That magnitude part of that transfer function if you went out and did this whole solution. Okay? So let's look at that in these kind of two cases then. Okay? So if omega is zero, I'm going to do, well, kind of fake some notation. Say, what's x bar when omega is zero? Well, let's see, that means that term goes away, that guy goes away. It's just that always, right? Okay. Well, I can get, I'm going to call the frequency at which that peak occurs omega peak. And that might be the natural frequency, might be almost the natural frequency, might be a little bit different. You kind of estimate where that peak occurs, measure that peak amplitude. Okay. And that ends up being that, just plugging, I'll make a peak for my input frequency. Well, if those things are pretty close to being the same, let's say, well, that term, it's going to be pretty small, so it's basically zero. Okay. And then I end up with that, right? You get n squared comes out. Yep. Okay. And I then can look at and I end up with that. I take care of all that math. Okay. For lightly damped systems, which we've kind of assumed when we said those are about the same. Okay. So for lightly damped systems, what's this square root term? Yeah, basically just one. Right. So lightly damped, zeta is small. Something small squared is really small. So one minus some small stuff is just one. We get an approximation for our damping ratio by just looking at what's the magnitude of this peak, what's the magnitude down at really, really low frequency. Just from our fairly simple so far understanding of a second order harmonic oscillator. You can take an oscillatory system, our ball system on the desk in front of us, and push it back and forth a little bit, figure out its natural frequency and damping ratio. It's kind of cool. Okay. So that's one way we can do it. Let's look at another way. Somebody stole their eraser back, huh? Okay, I'm going to redraw this. Got the same. So what we just talked about, what's problematic about that maybe? What of what we just discussed would be hard to do? Finding. Finding the exact peak, right?
Yeah.
So that's not so easy maybe. Right? Remember we said your system could be getting damaged while you're trying to find that peak, so you gotta be careful about that. Okay? At low damping, that peak becomes kind of a small range of frequencies, right? So finding the exact peak, again, can be non-trivial to do. Okay. Let's look at another method, maybe in an attempt to get rid of those problems. We'll see if it helps or not. Okay. Okay, I'm going to move this over a little bit just so we get a wider plot for us to work with. So we kind of zoomed in a little bit all around that peak frequency. It looks like it's kind of things are shifted, but we're just zoomed in. Okay. And we found some kind of peak frequency. We're going to call it omega p. So the frequency at which that peak occurs. Okay. Excuse me. And we can look at match our notes. This is basically magnitude, right, is what that height is there. Okay. What I want to then do is look for those points on this plot, plots of that magnitude, and find them. Okay. Those are half power points. So, I do the same trick. I sweep over the frequency range that I want to analyze this system in. Over. And maybe I can get data up here. Maybe I don't do such a good job. So I have data and I'm trying to approximate this frequency response. And I want to figure out this peak, if I can. Okay. And then I want to figure out the frequency at which these two half power points occur. Okay. Omega 1, omega 2. Yes, sir.
Is that omega P or omega P?
Omega P. Sorry. P for peak. Okay. So let's define delta. My notes. The difference between omega 1 and omega 2, or omega 2 minus omega 1, is delta H, some kind of frequency range between these two half power points. Okay. That actually tells us a lot. If we're able to get that, we have zeta right away. The denominator. Look at that. So we have another estimate of damping ratio from a frequency response plot. So we just figured out two ways to get damping information from a frequency response plot. Okay. What's the problem with this way, maybe? Do I know omega n? Kind of, right? I think it's still going to depend on what? How sharp this peak is, right? If it's a pretty sharp peak there, you can say, hey, this is going to be omega n. Omega p is omega n, approximate, right? But yeah, it depends on you knowing, strictly speaking, omega n. Yeah, what other problems are here? I still need to be able to measure this peak in some way. And we've discussed, hey, that's maybe a problem. What other problems happen with this method in particular? Yeah, so these half power points, right? As the damping ratio goes down, what happens to this peak? Damping ratio goes down, what happens to the peak? It's higher, right? What happens to kind of its width? It gets thinner kind of as damping ratio goes down, right? So if I have a lightly damped system, I can maybe end up in the place where this peak's going to be really high, but then the half power points are kind of spaced close together in the frequency domain. Right? So delta H can end up being small. So I may or may not have the resolution in my testing equipment to be able to excite the system at a small enough increment of frequency to be able to excite these two points and get that information if the system is lightly damped. And then, of course, we have the normal experimental problems. All this data is noisy, right? Sensors are wrong, always. Are they wrong enough to matter? You have to figure that out. Yep.
Whenever you're getting this data, how do you know when to stop before like breaking your system? Like how close do you get to
the How do you know when to stop? Before things start breaking is when you should stop. Depends on it's not a very satisfying answer, but it depends. Right. So for example, I could excite the crane system, a crane doing this, and if nothing's in the workspace of the crane just starts swinging back and forth like crazy. Which is kind of fun, a little bit dangerous, but it's not going to really break anything for the most part. Right? You have a fragile, you're doing platter, still spinning hard drive tests, which are still used a lot in servers and things, right? So you're trying to test the hard drive. That stuff can go bad there, right? So it depends on what you're testing. You're working on a $100 million satellite. You probably want to be a bit more careful. So it depends is the short answer. Okay, so we just talked about two frequency domain approaches. Which one should I use? It'll depend on the system. What's the cost? Like, what's the real cost of doing either one of these methods? Time, where's that time spent, though? Collecting the data. Right? If I have the data already, if I have my little white X's down there, does doing both methods really cost me that much more? No, right? So the expense of doing this is in really figuring out what the data is, gathering the data, doing both of these calculations, you know, comparing this to that, and then doing the half power, that's nothing now. Right? That's write the code once and use it for the rest of your career, basically. 30 seconds after you have the data. So, like we talked in the time domain stuff, do both. Compare the answers, right? And in fact, you probably will want to do this multiple times, right? Measure the data, get more data. In fact, sometimes what you'll end up doing is do a rough. If you don't know the system, really don't know the system, you can do a rough estimation of the curve. And then, okay, around the peak, I'm going to be very careful and approach that peak more carefully, right? So if I can't excite there, if I'm able to map out this part really easily, or really well, really fine frequency grid going up to that peak, I can maybe interpolate what that needs to be. But once you have the data, it costs you nothing to do both methods. Right. Yes?
On the first one, you put the phase diagram.
Yep.
How would you measure the dependence?
So I know, I'm glad you asked that. We have maybe a question if we get to it, right? I know that my force input something like that in a steady state, and I know what my force is because that's what I'm commanding. Right? Then I look at the response, and maybe it looks something. Probably not going to be one. Fix that. How do I figure out the phase difference between those two? Right. So should these be at the same frequency if it's at steady state? Yeah, they should be exactly the same frequency, right? The system's going to oscillate. If it's being forced, it's going to oscillate at the frequency that it's being forced, provided it's reached steady state. Right. So didn't draw it quite right. Like, you know, this guy needs to be over here somewhere. Right. It should be exactly the same frequency. Right. The magnitude will be different, right? And then you have, so how do I get phase shift out of this? So I can get some time difference. So I can look at zero crossings and get some time. How do I get time to phase? There you go. Right. I know one period of oscillation. Right? It's 2 pi, it's 360 degrees. I can map out tau. Okay. Well, I know if tau is 360 degrees, then t is something smaller. And there's my phase lag. So I can get the phase plot, and you can look for that 90-degree crossing, too. It's another place to start peeking out at natural frequency. Was that a hand back there or just stretching? All right. So we have frequency response, force response versions of the system ID stuff, time response versions of this. Which one of those should I use? Depends. I heard the right answer somewhere. Both? All of them? Yeah. Generally. Because now you have multiple estimates of zeta. You can start comparing them. Should the zeta we get here be the same if we did some time response thing? Should it? Should be pretty close. It's not going to be exactly the same because it's experimental data. But it should be pretty close to the same within the precision of my instruments, calculations, should be the same. Okay. Our first mini project, which will come up, probably end up getting assigned on Tuesday, but it's not due until after Mardi Gras, I think, the week after Mardi Gras. Will be largely a system identification project. We're going to take a system down in my lab. You guys are probably going to get to control it. I'm working on that part. Even if you don't get to control it, you're going to get a bunch of data from the system. We'll get to at least drive it around, see it moving, and then get data. And then you're going to have to tell me some stuff about the system. What's the natural frequencies? What are the damping ratio? That kind of stuff. So that's a real job you would do if you're in a kind of vibrations department in some company. Here's our piece of machinery. It's vibrating, breaking stuff. Figure out what's going on. First step of that, figure out what the natural frequencies and damping ratios are. Okay, questions, system ID stuff. It'll be a group project. Yeah. Questions? Okay. All right then. So that effectively wraps the theoretical, analytical part of chapter 2. We'll still work a few more problems and keep working problems at least through next week, your exam time. But we're done with the theory piece of it at least. Okay. So, let's talk exam then. Week from today. In that sense, it covers everything in chapter 1 and 2. Okay. Everything's fair game. Okay. So let's talk about what that material really means. And we can do a little bit of a review in the process. Chapter 1 stuff. Two stuff. This overview will be posted, but just bullet points, so you might want to take more notes. Then we'll talk about more than this on the actual overview, of course. Okay. So in chapter 1, what's chapter 1 really all about? Free vibration, right. What's free vibration mean? Not force, basically initial condition problems, more or less. Right? There's no external non-conservative forces acting on the system. Right? Free vibration. Okay. So what do we really talk about in chapter 1 beyond that? To address understanding free vibration for systems. Equations of motion. Which I'll call modeling. So being able to write equations of motion. Say it again, I'm not going to tell you, hey, you better use Newton-Euler, you have to use Lagrange here. But there will be problems where one is more appropriate than the other. So that's your choice. If you want to know Newton-Euler front to back and that's all you do, that's fine. But you know you might end up with a problem that's not the best method for it. Just recognize that going in. Okay. We talked within generating, or kind of subtopics maybe of generating those equations of motion. We had the two methods. What else did we really learn about in terms of generating equations of motion, or once we have equations of motion, what else is in chapter 1, in other words? Yeah, linearization. Okay. And then once I have a linear system, getting from that equation of motion what the natural frequency and damping ratio are. Let's talk for just a second about linearization. What's the first choice I need to make if I'm going to linearize a system? I have to pick the point about which I'm going to try to linearize that system. We talked mostly about picking stable equilibrium points. But no, that's not necessarily always the case. If I have a highly nonlinear robotic arm, for example, and I know I'm always picking something up here and putting it down there, I might want to linearize about this set of operating conditions, even though that's not necessarily a stable equilibrium point, in order to design my controller and whatever. So that's the first step. The method we used is really a Taylor series expansion, and then assuming small angles allows us to ignore the higher order terms in that Taylor series expansion. Okay. What else we talk about in chapter 1? So this part gets us to a differential equation. What's next? Yeah, solving that They're all the same type, right? They're all second order, linear. In this case, non-forced differential equations, right? Ordinary differential equations. What does this get us to in the context of the vibration? Yeah, the time response, right? And that's the whole reason we would do that. Get to the time response. X of t equals theta of t equals. Okay, you might want to know that might save you a little bit of time if you're looking at equivalent springs. You can always get to the solution without using those equivalent spring relationships we looked at, but it might save you a few seconds if you recognize it. Okay. We said, hey, getting natural frequency and damping ratio. We have damping, we have that damp natural frequency to worry about as well, right? What does that look like? There we go, good. In free vibration, what frequency does a damped system oscillate at? Yeah, the damped natural frequency, right. Okay. So related to these are period, right? We can know the relationship between natural frequency and period. You know the damped natural frequency. If we have linear viscous damping, which is all we had talked about at this point of the course, what's the decay envelope look like for our initial condition response? It's an exponential decay, top and bottom. So be able to look at a response and say, hey, that looks like a normal second order damped harmonic oscillator. Be able to sketch an initial condition response for a few different damping ratios. Know how that might change if I double my damping ratio. Know how, what doubling the natural frequency, what impact that might have on the actual time response, both either in the equation or in a sketch of it. Okay. I'd be able to take some initial conditions for a given system and plot out a time response. Be able to plot out, hey, I'm starting at X equals X zero, okay? So for example, we might be given, hey, we have some initial position and I might have an initial velocity. Okay, what does this mean for how this plot is gonna have to start out? A negative initial velocity. Not at the peak of the sine curve, but what's this velocity? The first derivative of a curve gives you what about it? It's slope. So I know then that my initial slope of that curve has to be V naught. So I have some response then that might look like this for some amount of damping. All right. Or maybe, okay, sketch the same initial condition response with more damping. Sketch that initial condition response if there's no damping. Okay. Should also probably, in this sense, about kind of being able to write that in terms of sines and cosines, or sine and phase, cosine plus some phase shift. Maybe be able to identify or switch between those forms if necessary. Okay. Questions about the chapter one stuff? Okay. And a lot of this stuff is necessary for what we do in chapter two as well, right? I think this is definitely one of those courses where each chapter is not a silo. Right? Everyone's building on what we learned in the previous one. When we get to chapter four, it's going to be all this chapter two stuff we just did, but now there's more than one natural frequency and more than one damping ratio. We have multimode oscillation. So, in chapter two, what did we talk about? Well, what's the kind of larger theme? Force vibration. So we have some kind of input pushing on our system in some way. Most of what we concentrated on was pure harmonics. It's purely a sine or cosine or a complex exponential. It's pushing back and forth on the system, or moving a spring back and forth that's connected to the system. Okay? But before we got to those pure harmonics, we talked about one other kind of input. What was that? Step inputs. It should have been a little bit of a review of hopefully stuff you learned in controls. Step inputs and step responses, let's say. And I'd be able to do the same thing, be able to write the time response to a certain step input, be able to draw a sketch of that step response, the response to that step input, oh, step response. Be able to identify overshoot, settling time, rise time, all those parameters we can pick off that are properties of the system that we can pick off of a step response. Okay. Be able to talk about how those things change as I change my damping ratio. So we talked about step inputs, then we talked about when the book says seismic inputs, what do they mean? Yeah, some kind of position input. And it could be a velocity input, even if it's connected to a damper, but it's a position, right? Seismic inputs and the responses to those. What's the other main category of force response we looked at? Yeah, we... Now the responses to those two. With damping, without damping. When we're talking about the responses to either one of these, what's our solution procedure to get to from some kind of equation of motion to these responses? I have a seismic input to some flexible system. Told it's a pure harmonic. How do I get to what the actual response is? Yeah, I still have to solve the differential equation. Now we just have a pure harmonic in either one of these. So then what kind of solution do I need to assume? Yeah, you want to match the input, basically. Remember, if you have damping for either one of these, you either have to include both sine and cosine, or, if you're following my recommendation, drop into the complex form. Along the way, and you're getting that solution, will pass by transfer functions. They naturally drop out of that solution procedure. So you might be asked to, hey, write the transfer function between input y and output x. You will almost certainly be asked to draw a frequency response plot. Given this model, what does magnitude and phase look like as input frequency changes? And now, how does that change if the damping is 20% more? Or whatever. Yeah. These are the ones that, you know, if we're able to do that just like we talked through it in class before we wrote a single equation, it'll be all right there. Okay. Yes, sir.
Can you give us a certain percent change? Do we have to be super exact?
No. In fact, I probably wouldn't even ask you for, well, I'd probably ask for damping ratios, but as long as you get the trend right, it'll be fine. Yep. Yeah, we'll talk in just a second about kind of format of how this exam works, and you'll see why I don't do that, what you're asking about. Frequency response plots. Okay. So that's the meat of chapter 2, and that's kind of what you've had homework problems on, right? We also talked about some other stuff in chapter 2 that I recognize you haven't had homework problems on. So I'm probably not going to concentrate there, but I think our fair game at a high-level discussion. Okay. So we talked about, for example, and we'll work a problem a little bit later. Rotating imbalance. We saw in some ways this is really just a special case of a direct force input where the force comes from the rotating thing. Right. So I probably would be able to draw a frequency response for rotating balance. Right. I think we can, again, we got to that just intuitively without writing a single equation. Okay, so I think that part of rotating imbalance is probably fair game. You should be able to sketch that plot out. Okay. Real detailed solutions here, maybe. I think this one actually probably is fair game because it's pretty easy. Right. Can I model systems, right, all the way up until this point in the book? We're assuming viscous damping and no friction. Well, okay, well, how does mostly time response stuff change if I have friction instead of pure viscous damping? How does time response change if I have friction? Takes long. What about the frequency? No. Yeah, so the decay envelope is linear now, remember. Am I guaranteed to settle to zero? No. Okay. What frequency do we actually oscillate at when we have dry friction? Well, here's a hint, right? We saw that equation looks like this. I'll do it N. What frequency does that oscillate at? Yeah, just the natural frequency, actually. There's no really damp natural frequency when you have friction. Because we looked at, well, this guy is really just a constant force that happens to change sign depending on where I'm at in my cycle. So that has no effect on actually the frequency of oscillation. So I oscillate at my natural frequency when I have friction. So I think being able to model a system that has a little bit of friction, I think that's fair game. Right. And speak, give a sentence or two why that response might be different than if it was viscous damping? Okay. Then we've talked recently, and we're getting way a bit down the list, accelerometers and seismometers. And then we've talked most recently about system ID. So a lot of the system ID techniques we've talked about, if you're going to do them, strictly speaking, are kind of numerical heavy. Right, you got to calculate the difference between all these peaks and calculate a bunch of different times. So in some sense, they don't make a great test question. I'm not trying to test your arithmetic skills. Right. But they could be an add-on question. Okay, how would you actually measure the vibration of the system? You could use an accelerometer. You got this information back, and every one of these zetas looked different when you tested it. What does that mean about the system? What does that mean about the system? It's very likely nonlinear. So while doing a system ID procedure on the exam, right, I think is not necessarily appropriate, information that could be gained from a system ID is really testing knowledge of this stuff back here. So in that sense, I think it is fair game. So you got system ID results are this. What does that mean about natural frequency damper ratio? Is it linear? Right. Because really, that's knowledge of this stuff, not really system ID at that point. So like I said, we got two chapters. It's all there. Prior to the test will be, let's talk about how it sets up, three or four problems with multiple parts of each. Okay. So you can look at this and see something like a progression of a problem right in front of you. Okay. Here's a system, model it, give me the equations of motion. What's the natural frequency and damping ratio of the system you've been given? And you just develop the equation in motion for. Okay, well, assume that harmonic input zero right now. What's the time response? Sketch it out. Okay. Oh, now that input's not zero anymore, it's a pure harmonic. What's the transfer function? Sketch the frequency response. Right. The problems are mapped out right here for you. Okay. If you get equation of motion wrong in step one of a problem, I'm going to do my best to try to piece together, oh, if you'd gotten that part right, you would have gotten the rest of it right. So I think the more you can explain about what you're doing, the more I can help you. Right? I do give partial credit. I'm not just looking for the number out at the end. I'm trying to measure whether you guys know vibrations or not. Again, not how good you're at arithmetic or even calculus. So whenever you have the chance, demonstrate your vibration knowledge to me. That will help me help you. There will be, as it was very much related to that, no calculators. Okay? I'll bring your scratch paper for you. Okay, so when we get ready to take the test, we're going to clear your desk off. You're going to have a clear desk, pen or pencil, water bottle if you need it, tissue for your tears. I'll bring you the paper. I'll have a stapler here, everything for you. No calculators. There is an equation sheet. Equation sheet's already posted. Take a look at that. It'll be part of the exam packet for you. Questions?
What are we going to do Tuesday?
Tuesday, we're going to talk probably in a little bit more detail about SysID. Probably we'll go over the basis of that mini project because there is a little bit of Python stuff involved with that. And then that's probably going to take half a class, and then we'll work a few more examples for what we have time for, which with a little bit of time left today, we might be able to get to one example. But basically, everything we got through today And that'll be the same thing for second midterm, even the final. Well, we got through the week ahead of the final. That's the cutoff point. Right. The way I tend to do it. Other questions? Make sure, again, you're trying to demonstrate your vibration knowledge. Make sure you clearly indicate what your actual answer to any question is. Okay. Don't, I'm not saying you guys are, but don't play the game where you give me four answers and expect me to pick the right one. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to pick the wrong one. Okay. So, you know, box answers or indicate answers in some way. The more organized your work is, I think the better you'll do, but also the easier it'll be for me to give you partial credit if I can follow what you're doing, right? Okay. Again, this overview sheet, it's been up since yesterday, actually. And then the equation sheet you'll get with the exam is on the website, too. If you have questions about exam stuff, if you're working problems that are not part of the homework solutions, which I would recommend you do, and you want to talk about it, I'm around. Come knock on the door. Okay. Right. And we will take just the class period. So it's 12:30 to 1:45 by a real clock, not that one. If you need to take the test over in ODS, make sure you get in touch with me ahead of time. Okay, let's see. Okay, so I got a stack of examples. I'll post all these in the notes, even though we're not going to have a chance to get through very many of them. Okay, let's look at see, we have 15 minutes, 10 minutes. Problem 268. Basically, we're given a plot that looks like this. And we're told some information about this plot. This happens at. Ten radians a second. And that magnitude okay. And we're given, let's see. Well, let's talk at a high level first. What kind of response is this? Just looking at what you have so far, what would you guess? It's a frequency response, sure. But what kind of system? Looks undamped, you know. Can't really tell that for sure because the peak could be off the plot, but kind of indicating maybe it's undamped. What kind of system beyond that? Of the kind we've seen so far. Rotating imbalance, right? Remember, if we saw that rotating imbalance, hey, if the down here, my rotating imbalance is not rotating. So of course I'm not vibrating at all. I'm zero amplitude. And then out at high speed, basically a kind of a constant force acting on the thing, I got to a fixed amplitude. Okay. And we are given that this is actually X bar. Okay. So the problem set up that, hey, this was a rotating imbalance. So we figured that part out correctly. And it had, they had kind of this kind of setup where there's an M2 over there. That guy was X. That distance, they tell us, M1. So that offset mass, the rotating balance is m2, the mass of the body is m1. And we have a k there, and then the mass 2 is 0.1, and it's meters, but I left off the m to avoid confusing with it being a mass there. So what we want to know given this plot, what's the spring constant? How do we get to that? It's omega n. So we know omega n is at least approximately that, right? That peak's happening near the natural frequency at least. We know the amplitude of this output. What does this constant end up being in terms of that rotating imbalance? Do you guys remember that? If we have it normalized, remember it was that e beta over there, right? So we know something about, we can calculate eccentricity, we can get some information about masses and things too. So those two pieces of information, if we know that in the limit as omega goes out to infinity, we get this, and remember beta is that mass ratio. Okay. So I can look at just two pieces of information from this plot, really, and I'm told it's a basic rotating imbalance. I can figure out system parameters from that. The details of that are in the notes. You guys see the high-level procedure there, though? I mean, just knowing the fundamentals of what this plot looks like and understanding what it might represent get us to a lot of information about that system, actually. More details in the notes. Okay. We'll save these two. I'll put them in the notes today, but we'll also work them on, probably look at them in more detail on Tuesday. Yep. Settles where? E beta, yeah. So where that's E. Okay. Let's look at problem. I think we can discuss this at a high level in the 5 minutes we have left. 278, you're given an equation of motion. And what you're tasked with doing in this problem, this represents some oscillatory system, we're saying, right? It has a pure harmonic input. Okay. What's the peak magnitude of oscillation of the system? And they ask you to do that without solving the equation of motion, without solving this differential equation directly. Right? So we can solve this directly. We can figure out what x of t is, take the derivative, find when that's zero, and you get maximum, right? How can I get there without that? What do I know about this system just from this equation? Oh, natural frequency is what? Radians a second, right? What else do I know? Amplitude of the input. Yeah, so maybe y bar for some. What else do I know? Zeta. Yeah, I can get to zeta. I know that 2 zeta omega n has to be that, right? I know what omega n is. I can figure out what my damping ratio is. Okay. With that information, how can we get to when what the peak amplitude of response for the system might be? What tells me the amplitude of response given some input, harmonic input? What maps input to output? Transfer function. So I have, in this case, a second order system. I can write a transfer function for that. Right, just straight from here. And then I can look at, well, okay, at what omega is that transfer function maximized? It's going to be near omega n, but we have damping, right? So it's not omega n. That's going to be omega d. Right? So you could plug in that value, do that, and get to some estimate of when the actual peak amplitude is going to be. Just from working from the equation of motion. Details of that are in those two. And I think we're out of time. So see you guys on Tuesday.